This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
He's a superstar of climate scientists, even though he didn't choose that. Dr. Michael Mann was already a leading American climate expert in 2001 when he became a lead author for the third scientific assessment report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. That report featured a stunning graphic showing global temperature data for the past 1,000 years. It was gathered from a huge variety of measurements by scientists all over the world. Because this graph showed a steep rise upward over the past century or so, it was called the hockey stick. That image and its lead author became the target and punching bag for the fossil fuel industry and a wild bunch of climate deniers. Mann was attacked at his university. He was a target of the so-called ClimateGate hacked emails, carefully timed to damage the 2009 Copenhagen climate talks. It got so bad that Virginia Attorney General Ken Cusinelli demanded an investigation into Michael Mann by the University of Virginia. Thankfully, the university successfully fought off that man in court, striking a blow for academic freedom. Michael Mann sued the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the National Review for their attacks on the hockey stick graph and himself and his science. We'll get an update on that, perhaps. And through it all, Michael Mann has certainly taken on science as a contact sport, appearing many times in media, including debating climate deniers. He co-founded the authoritative voice of science, realclimate.org. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Mann also continued his prodigious scientific research to unearth evidence of climate change. His work has won too many awards to list them all here. Dr. Michael E. Mann is Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University. He is part of the Department of Geosciences and the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute. He's also director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Michael Mann, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. It's good to be with you.
I'm guessing if we met in 1995, you would be a busy scientist with no idea you would become a climate celebrity and target as well. Did you see this coming?
Well, no, not really. When I decided to major in applied math and physics in college and go on to graduate school in physics, I didn't really envision that I would somehow find myself at the center of one of the most contentious societal debates that we've ever had. And that is because of this graph we published, the so-called hockey stick graph, back in the late 1990s, and it became this iconic symbol in the climate change debate. And so I found myself somewhat unexpectedly, unintentionally, reluctantly in the center of this fractious debate.
It's tempting to talk about the climate deniers, but our listeners are way beyond that. We know it's real. Some of us think it's too late now to avoid wrenching changes to everything for all the species. Michael, have humans wasted too much time already?
Well, we certainly have wasted too much time. We had enough information to act decades ago. By the late 1980s, it was already becoming fairly clear that human-caused climate change wasn't just a theoretical construct. It was happening. We were beginning to see the impacts. And of course, those impacts have gotten greater and the risks have grown since then. And unfortunately, even though the science really was in decades ago, the science demonstrating that the globe is warming, that the climate is changing, that it's caused by human activity, in particular increased greenhouse gas concentrations from the burning of fossil fuels. We had enough information to act at that point. And if we had acted, we would have averted much of the damaging climate change impacts that we have already seen in the form of more destructive hurricanes, more extensive, prolonged drought in the western U.S., more extreme rainfall events, flooding events. You name it, we have seen climate change impacts in the form of more extreme weather of various types, sea level rise, increased drought, increased extreme heat, all of these things taking its toll on our economy, on human health, on our national security. So we've already paid a price, the price of inaction. And unfortunately, that is in part because of a very well-funded, very well-organized disinformation campaign by industry front groups associated with the fossil fuel industry and private fossil fuel interests like the Koch brothers, Koch Industries. Unfortunately, because of their efforts to forestall action and to poison the public discourse, we are now at a point where it is getting late for action. It's late in the game if we are to avert truly dangerous and potentially irreversible changes in our climate.
Just 10 years ago, we had reports like the Stern Report in the UK, which accepted greenhouse gases in the atmosphere could be safely reined in around 550 parts per million carbon dioxide or even higher. What does science know about safe emission levels now?
Well, you know, the only safe emissions are no emissions. We are already at a point where we are seeing damaging climate change impacts. And, you know, if you talk to some experts, you'll often hear a couple numbers cited. 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. Right now, we're just about at 400. At pre-industrial levels, we're about 280. So at current rates of fossil fuel burning, we will hit 450 parts per million in a matter of a couple decades, and 550 parts per million later this century. That would be twice pre-industrial levels. We would have doubled the concentration of CO2 in our atmosphere. And one of those numbers I said is 450 parts per million. You hear from scientists when we talk about the dangerous level of human interference with the climate, and you hear the number 2 degrees Celsius, that's 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit warming relative to pre-industrial. We think that if we reach 450 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, which again we will do within a couple decades at current rates of fossil fuel burning, we will commit to at least 2 degrees Celsius warming of the planet. And if you look at the impacts of that amount of warming, it is reasonable to say that at that level, we have reached truly dangerous levels of interference with the climate, and we will pay the price in terms of the cost to our economy, our health, loss of land, access to fresh water, food production, you name it, across the board. Beyond that amount of warming, we're starting to see, you know, we start to see a fundamentally degraded planet and a fundamentally degraded opportunity for us to, you know, prosper as a civilization.
We hear this 400 parts per million of CO2 these days, but does that include the rising levels of methane and all the other exotic greenhouse gases that humans are churning out?
That's right. And so typically we talk about a quantity that's called equivalent CO2. So it sort of lumps together CO2 and the other greenhouse gases like methane and even surface ozone, that pollutant is also a greenhouse gas. Nitrous oxide, which is a byproduct of agriculture, is also a greenhouse gas. And if you add together all those greenhouse gases, then you can represent their net impact in terms of the equivalent amount of CO2. And if you do that, it turns out we are already above 450 parts per million CO2 equivalent. So if you put all those gases together, we're already past the 450 equivalent CO2 mark. On the other hand, we have also produced a lot of industrial pollutants known as aerosols, like sulfate particulates that are produced from industrial activity like coal burning. That has offset global warming in some regions. So that has actually sort of masked some of the warming we would otherwise have seen. And if we do transition away from burning of fossil fuels, then we will stop the increase of CO2 in the atmosphere. But ironically, we will also cease the very activities that have sustained this additional cooling factor, these aerosol particulates. And so that means that it'll be even a little harder for us to keep the climate from warming above 2 degrees Celsius, because we're also going to lose this factor that was offsetting some of the warming.
We hear a chorus of people who worry frozen methane in the seabed will reach melting temperature and cause a sudden shift of warming. How do you assess the methane risk?
Yeah, so, you know, methane, when we talk about methane, there are two different things going on. There's the methane that we produce, the methane that leaks into the atmosphere, for example, when we engage in fracking, efforts to remove natural gas from beneath the Earth's surface. And in the process of doing that, some of that natural gas, which is largely methane, actually escapes into the atmosphere. Methane is also produced by farming activities, agriculture. It is produced by damming. The construction of very large dam projects also contribute methane. So we are raising the concentration of this other very potent greenhouse gas, methane, through certain human activities. But then there's this other thing that we call a feedback. To be specific, we call it a carbon cycle feedback, and that's a pretty technical sounding term. But what it means is, as we warm the Earth, there is this aggravating effect that by warming the Earth, we actually potentially essentially melt some of the methane that was frozen either in the coastal shelves of the oceans or in the permafrost in the Arctic. And that methane is then released into the atmosphere. And so it's what we call a positive feedback, but that's not a good thing. A positive feedback in this case is it's a vicious cycle, which means the warming releases this methane that had been trapped in either the permafrost or along the coastal shelves. That goes into the atmosphere and causes even more warming. And so there is some concern about the possibility that these methane feedbacks could kick in relatively soon. Now, there's a pretty robust debate right now within the scientific community, a legitimate and honest debate between scientists with different viewpoints about just how large a factor that's likely to be. Some scientists don't think, you know, this methane feedback will substantially add to the main factor, which is our burning of fossil fuels and putting CO2 into the atmosphere. CO2 stays in the atmosphere a very long time, many centuries. Much of the CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere will be in the atmosphere for centuries. Methane, on the other hand, has a much shorter lifetime in the atmosphere, on the order of decades or so. And so some scientists say, you know, the long-term problem here really is the CO2. And methane, the discussion of methane, to some extent they see as a distraction from the central issue, which is the carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels. But methane is a wild card, and it's something we have to keep in mind, and there is always the possibility that there are surprises that may loom out there, things that we didn't expect to happen because our knowledge is imperfect, because our science is imperfect. We can't say with absolute certainty precisely what will happen, and some of those uncertainties may break against us. It's possible, for example, that these methane feedbacks may be more substantial than many scientists think, and we could be in for even greater changes and more damaging impacts than we currently are able to project with our models. That's worth keeping in mind. Uncertainty is not a reason for inaction. Uncertainty is actually a reason for taking even faster action, engaging in even more urgent efforts to reduce our carbon emissions because of the possibility that the impacts could be even worse than we are currently projecting.
Scientists have told our listeners recently that there have been some big changes in the climate in short periods of time in the past. Do you believe abrupt climate change is possible in the coming decades?
Well, it is. There are, you know, potential so-called tipping points within the climate system, which is to say aspects of the climate where if you push on them even slightly, they suddenly essentially go over a cliff. So even a little bit of a nudge, a little bit of a push can lead to a very large change. And one example that's often cited is the North Atlantic current, known as the North Atlantic Drift. It's an extension of the Gulf Stream that carries warm water up towards Europe into the North Atlantic. And there is evidence from model simulations, for example, that melting of ice could actually end up either shutting down or at least greatly weakening that ocean current system. And if that happens, it can happen very abruptly. It's one of those things that does behave a little bit like a tipping point. You put enough fresh water into the North Atlantic because of the melting of all the ice, And that very light fresh water inhibits, all of a sudden, the sinking motion in the North Atlantic that drives this current system. So that's a possible tipping point. Another possible tipping point, in fact, it's probably not even just a possible tipping point, it's a likely tipping point. It's one we may have already passed, has to do with the West Antarctic ice sheet. There's some recent science that has been published just within the last few months, so it's even more recent than the science in the latest IPCC report, the latest report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. These new studies suggest that we have now warmed the southern oceans enough that they are going to destabilize large parts of the ice shelves that currently support the West Antarctic ice sheet. In other words, it may already be, its fate may already have been sealed. There may be nothing we can do to prevent the collapse of a very large part of the West Antarctic ice sheet. And if that happens, then that alone contributes somewhere between, 10 and 13 or 14 feet, somewhere between 3 to 5 meters of sea level rise, which would be fairly catastrophic, especially if it were to unfold on a time scale as short as a century or so. And we can't rule that out. The current estimates are that it would take many centuries for that to happen. We have already set it in motion, but it will ultimately play out very slowly over several centuries. But we can't rule out the possibility that it could play out more rapidly, in which case we suddenly have a crisis when it comes to protecting the major cities of the world, many of which are at or close to sea level and will be either destroyed or fundamentally degraded by that level of that much sea level rise.
As we face a climate crisis, the National Academy just gave a green light to doing more research into geoengineering, like artificially creating more cloud cover. Should we develop that lifeboat tech in case the climate becomes much worse, much faster than we thought?
Well, there has been quite a bit of discussion, and there were these studies that came out. The National Academy of Sciences published two studies last week about, the so-called geoengineering, ways of sort of engineering, trying to engineer our way out of human-caused climate change. The report certainly does convey some apprehension about the implementation of these methods, and I have to say I myself am very frightened at some of the schemes that have been suggested, because we could end up doing more damage than if we had not intervened at all. It's sort of the law of unintended consequences. And, I sort of liken myself as a climate scientist to sort of a planetary doctor. We've sort of diagnosed the problem, human-caused climate change. We know its cause. It's increasing greenhouse gas concentrations from fossil fuel burning and other human activities. And we should hold true to the same principle that scientists hold true to. First, do no harm. And in my view, geoengineering violates that principle of first doing no harm, because we could actually end up making things even worse if we, for example, shoot large amounts of particulates, sulfate particulates, into the atmosphere to sort of mimic what a large volcanic eruption does. But we, do this every few years to try to put enough of these cooling particles into the atmosphere, into the lower stratosphere, to offset the warming effect of greenhouse gases. We could end up shifting rainfall patterns. We could change the positions of the storm tracks. We could actually create worse drought over most of the continents. We could worsen the ozone depletion problem as well. There are all sorts of things that we can imagine might go wrong. And then there are all those things that could go wrong that we haven't yet even imagined. So I myself am nervous about many of these schemes, and I think that they potentially provide a crutch for those who don't want to do the hard work of mitigation. It's tougher, perhaps, but essential to engage in the actions that we know can stop global warming, stopping the emission of carbon into the atmosphere. And I fear that the idea that holding out these geoengineering scenarios is a convenient way for some to sort of sidetrack the discussion of mitigation it's a way to sort of try to make the argument that, well, we can continue to burn carbon, we'll just do some of this other stuff and it'll all be okay. And there's no evidence that that's the case, that these schemes are safe. There's no evidence that we couldn't end up making things even worse through most of these interventions. Now, some of these schemes are fairly, you know, they're fairly innocuous in terms of the potential consequences. For example, what's known as open air capture of CO2, basically sucking the CO2 back out of the atmosphere through a fairly sophisticated and frankly quite expensive technology, where you're sort of simulating what trees and plants do. They suck CO2 out of the atmosphere, but there are ways that we could do that much more efficiently. And it would be expensive to deploy this, but it would potentially offset the buildup CO2 in the atmosphere, and there are no obvious negative consequences of doing that, other than the fact that it's really expensive to do that. It's really expensive to try to put the genie back in the bottle. Much easier to try to keep the genie in the bottle, which is what mitigation is all about, stopping the escalation of fossil fuel burning and CO2 buildup in our atmosphere.
Michael Mann, you were attacked for the crime of doing science, apparently, and even the Attorney General of Virginia got into the act. I just have to ask you, as we wrap up our interview today, what is happening with your lawsuit against the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the National Review?
Okay, well, that's a pending legal matter, so I can't actually talk about that. But what I can talk about are the larger battles that I have had to fight against industry-funded front groups who have engaged in attacks against climate scientists like myself in an effort to try to distract the public, to try to cloud the public's understanding of the solidness of the scientific evidence for climate change. And I personally have been subject to, as you allude to, efforts by powerful politicians who were in the pay of fossil fuel interests, who sought to abuse their power by subjecting me to congressional subpoenas and calling me to testify in the House and the Senate in hostile hearings, in any number of ways, both politicians in the pay of fossil fuel industry and front groups and organizations who advocate for the fossil fuel industry have been doing everything possible to try to discredit this graphic that we published a decade and a half ago, the so-called hockey stick graph, because it has become this a very powerful image that demonstrates just how unprecedented the warming that we are seeing really is. And because it was such a potent image, the special interests who don't want to see us transition away from our reliance on fossil fuels, because they profit from it greatly right now, have done everything they can to try to attack my science, often through engaging in personal attacks and efforts to intimidate me personally. And I actually wrote a whole book called The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, which is about my experiences as sort of a reluctant and accidental public figure in the larger debate over human-caused climate change. And I try to share the lessons that I've learned and, you know, why I've decided to embrace that role as a because it provides me an opportunity to do something that I think is very important, to try to inform this critical discussion of what we are going to do about this mounting problem, the problem of human-caused climate change.
We've been talking with one of the most famous climate scientists of our time, Dr. Michael Mann from Penn State University. I want to thank you so much for keeping up the fight and for talking with us through media large and small. It's appreciated.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Find links to pretty well everything we've discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.